Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. President Bush is urging Americans to return to normalcy, but to many, business as usual will not do. In fact, our terrifying September surprise was not entirely surprising to some who understand the increasingly global impact of grinding poverty, political instability, and religious fanaticism. Our guest tonight says that America needs to face hard truths about the world around it or face a coming anarchy. First, an update on the effort to aid Afghan refugees inside and outside the country. Today, the UN Refugee Agency said it has delivered more emergency aid to Pakistan, where Afghans have sought refuge for two decades. And this week, President Bush promised $100 million in new aid to Afghan refugees. Susanna Price is Pakistan Bureau Chief for the BBC. She speaks to us from Islamabad. Hello, Susanna.
Hello.
Susanna, Pakistan is already hosting about 2 million Afghan refugees driven over the border by civil war and drought, and more are trickling across the border, even though it's closed. How is the Pakistani government dealing with them?
Well, Pakistan has basically closed its border to any new refugees. Pakistan says it has more than 2 million, and this is a huge drain on its resources, and it really can't take any more. So last November, actually, it closed its border to any new refugees, but it's really been reinforcing that now. However, that doesn't mean that no refugees are getting through. It's a very long border. It's more than 1,500 miles, and it's very porous. So you're getting refugees coming through mountain passes, coming on donkeys and on foot, and also bribing their way across. Now, if the Pakistanis find those who've come across illegally, they are deporting them. But at the moment, the numbers coming across are in their thousands rather than the tens and hundreds of thousands that are feared if there are American strikes.
And yet we read worst-case scenario estimates that there could be as many as 1.5 million more Afghan refugees pouring into Pakistan in case of those strikes and turmoil there. Is the Pakistani government at all prepared for that? Where will they put them? What are the risks that a flood of Afghans might destabilize Pakistan?
Well, I think Pakistan's extremely worried about these UN estimates. The Pakistani government has said it will open the border, most likely to open the border, if that comes about. I think probably the pressure of numbers will just force it to open the border, and it's extremely concerned. The UN Refugee Agency has been looking at various sites which have been earmarked by the Pakistani government for the refugees. Now, Pakistan, because it doesn't want these refugees coming into the cities, integrating with the population, it suggested sites very close to the border with Afghanistan, and these are in very arid, desert-like conditions. In some areas, you have to dig several feet to find any water. They're in the middle of nowhere. There's no access. So it's going to be very difficult, I think, to set up proper refugee camps with sanitation, with water, with food coming in.
There are already a number of relief agencies responding to the situation. How effective is the relief effort? What's the situation of refugees there now?
The relief effort in Pakistan is basically contingency planning at the moment. The UN Refugee Agency has been flying in plastic sheeting, blankets, kitchen sets, ready for the expected influx. Other countries, such as Britain, has been flying tents into Iran. So they're really building up the supplies in anticipation of the refugees coming. There's not really much aid going to the refugees who've already come across.
In other words, Pakistan is supporting those 2 million out of its own pocket?
No, the 2 million that are here already are being supported by the aid agencies already.
Mm-hmm.
They've set up refugee camps. They provide some food aid for them. But Pakistan, before this crisis happened, had made it very clear that it really wanted to see them starting to move, starting to go back. Because although Pakistan isn't directly funding the refugee camps out of its own pockets, it says the sheer numbers, especially the numbers in the cities and in the towns, are a drain on resources. It says the Afghans are taking jobs. It says they're responsible for gun running, for drug culture, for increase in violence. So for all these reasons, politically, the Afghans were becoming unpopular. Of course, given this present crisis, they can't start sending them home now, but it explains their extreme reluctance to welcome any more unless they really have to.
Well, what about helping Afghans inside their own country? There's the threat of starvation as winter approaches, we hear. 200 tons of wheat were just shipped to Kabul and more on the way. What are the chances that an airdrop of food will stay out of the Taliban's hands and go to people who need it?
Well, this has been one of the great worries. And in fact, the food that's starting to come in is the first food that the UN has sent in since the attacks on New York and Washington. And they said up to now they were too worried about the security situation. They found it very difficult to find transport. And there were worries about the food being taken by the Taliban. But I think now the situation has become so desperate. There are 300,000 people in the north of Afghanistan who are simply going to run out of food within the next few days that I think the World Food Programme has felt it had to start moving. So it sent in a few convoys, but really we're just talking about a few hundred tons of wheat at the moment, which is a drop in the ocean. Really, there are deadlines to be met here. Basically, winter is approaching, and by the end of November, it's going to be extremely difficult to bring in aid to a lot of the remote areas of Afghanistan. And the aid agencies are desperate to bring in as much food aid as possible because they want people to stay in the areas they live in. They want to be able to feed them in their villages and in the countryside where they are. They don't want a mass movement inside Afghanistan and, of course, ultimately out to Pakistan. But it's a difficult process. The UN has problems because its foreign staff have all been forced to leave. Its communications have practically been cut off. The local staff who are there are obviously extremely capable, but they have their own security to think of. So they're working, the UN and all the other NGOs are working under extremely difficult conditions. But I think now they see it's a crisis. There are 7 million people desperately in need of food aid, and they can't back out of that. They have to get the food in.
It sounds like we could have a humanitarian, military, and political crisis all at once there. We've all seen the photographs of bags of wheat labeled USA being carried in the region. Is there any chance that emergency aid might help tip public support further away from the Taliban, or does it really matter to people who are starving?
I think people will be relieved to see that aid is coming in. They will feel that the international community hasn't abandoned them. That will be very important for them. I think maybe in the cities, in Kabul and Kandahar, there will be a realization that the United States, for example, isn't cutting off aid, isn't trying to starve them out or force them into some kind of rebellion. So I think that will register. But I think in the majority of the country, they'll just be grateful for food aid wherever it comes from, and they won't be particularly involved in supporting one party or another.
Susanna Price covers Afghanistan and Pakistan for the BBC. She's joined us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Thank you, Susanna.
My pleasure.
Many Americans are bewildered by the terrorist attacks last month. Why do they hate us so much? Writer Robert Kaplan has spent two decades finding answers to that question in West Africa, the Balkans, and the Middle East. He has a hard-eyed view of the post-Cold War era. The world, he says, has split into countries that produce goods and services and countries that produce chaos. And America has naively ignored that widening gulf at its own peril. Robert Kaplan, the traveler, author, and Atlantic Monthly correspondent, says we will not save the world with microchips. We will not even save the world, he says, with democracy. Listeners, can you accept Robert Kaplan's stark view of the world? Have the events of September 11 finally slapped America awake? Are you beginning to understand how terrorism can thrive in the 21st century? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Good evening, Robert Kaplan.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us tonight. We're also joined tonight by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Hello, Jack.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Jack.
Hey, Bob.
Okay. So we're all here, gang.
Yeah.
Robert Kaplan, in the wake of everything that transpired last month, we are hungry right now for your tell-it-like-it-is eye on the world. Take us, if you will, on a quick tour of the Islamic world. What should we know there as we wade into this new war on terrorism?
Well, the degree to which I can condense it in a few sentences, Tom, here is how I would put it.
Go for it.
Very generally speaking, with a lot of exceptions, the Islamic world from Morocco to Indonesia is a world of weak, flimsy institutions. There are exceptions in Egypt and Turkey and other places, and Iran, for example. But mainly, this is a part of the world where institutions are weak, and therefore the power of a few individuals in large geographical spaces is very strong.
By institutions, do you mean government?
I mean bureaucracies. Yes, exactly. Bureaucracies, the things that make a rule of law. That protect men from other men so that everyone can go around conducting peaceful commerce. And where institutions, bureaucracies, governmental agencies are generally weak and capricious, power is respected all the more. Authority of one or two men, intimidation, is respected all the more. And in this kind of circumstance, people are easily intimidated. You see this in the Egyptian media. The Egyptian media will go off on binges, attacking Israel or attacking America. The fact that the Egyptian media is freer now than it has been, say, 15 years ago, doesn't make it calmer or more objective, because they all kind of follow the leader to a degree that doesn't even exist in the United States, because there is an incredible degree of intimidation, of brute force, of thuggery.
But let's take that as an example.
Implicit, but, that it doesn't even have to be stated.
But Robert Kaplan, who are we talking about as the leader there? Certainly not Mubarak.
Right. What we're talking about are the fundamentalists or the Islamists. And this is why Mubarak himself has been speaking and acting like somebody who's looking over his shoulder, very frightened. Why he has been harder and it's been more and more difficult for him to help us, because he is faced, as is King Mohammed VI of Morocco and many other leaders, with a population that increasingly every year has a larger percentage of young, unemployed men who are increasingly attracted to radical causes. While the terrorists themselves may have been middle class or first or second generation middle class, and we can go into that later, that's very interesting. The fact is, the people who are attracted to them, who find them as heroes, tend to come from the lower working classes, the badly urbanized millions. And because of this, the moderate or semi-secular leaders in the Arab world are increasingly frightened, increasingly intimidated, and it's increasingly hard for them to stick out their necks to help us.
So who do we support here? You've torn into these governments as kleptocracies, dependent on military law, gargantuan, useless bureaucracies, parasites, and right on down the line. It almost makes us want to sympathize with these angry folks down at the bottom of the social pyramid.
Yes, well, I do sympathize with them on a personal level to the degree that I can empathize with how they feel and why they feel it. However, the stark political reality is that any government that would replace Mubarak in Egypt, President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in Tunisia, King Mohammed VI in Morocco, King Abdullah in Jordan, et cetera, would probably 9 out of 10 chances be even more oppressive, more restrictive, more absolutist than the present generation of leaders.
So, do we have the United States? Do we have no room to maneuver here? We're stuck with the kleptocracies, as you call them?
I think we have a lot of room to maneuver. We're stuck with them, but they're not so bad. I think in many ways they're modernizing leaderships. You know, modernization occurs little by little in a very tortured process. I have seen, going back and forth to Jordan over the decades, how increasingly open that society has become. Americans, we like to think that you go from, say, Mao Zedong to Gerhard Schroeder overnight. From a communist dictator to an enlightened German prime minister just by snapping your finger and declaring democracy. But the fact is that this can take centuries, or a century, or several decades at least. And the Muslim world is just at the beginning of this great journey. And in the first few decades of this journey, you're going to tend to get the very liberalization that we want and champion will tend to produce even more nationalism. Erratic regimes, so that liberalization will lead to instability in the short run. But the short run could last 10 or 15 or 20 years. Just look at Iran.
Robert Kaplan, let us come back to that. We've got to take a quick break here. Listeners, we're talking to Robert Kaplan, global traveler and interpreter extraordinaire, with his tough view of the world. But we're ready to hear it tonight. Call us with your response to Robert Kaplan's view. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror from WBUR Boston.
From Boston.
From WBUR Boston, this is Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Robert Kaplan and his vision of the coming anarchy. Are we mentally and emotionally ready to deal with the consequences of global poverty and chaos? How will we extricate America from its current crisis? Can we prevent future holocausts here and abroad? We're talking with Robert Kaplan, author and analyst. His latest book of last year, is The Coming Anarchy. Our news analyst, Jack Beatty, is also here. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join online at WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Robert Kaplan, we happen to know that you're preparing an article for The Atlantic Monthly on Samuel Huntington, the Harvard social scientist who propounded at the time of the Gulf War the controversial thesis that the West was locked in a clash of civilizations with the Islamic world. Explore that Huntington thesis for us and tell us how far you think it fits in the present crisis.
All right. Well, first of all, yes, I am doing a long piece on Professor Huntington, but it doesn't just deal with the clash of civilizations.
Okay.
It deals with all of his books going back to the 1950s.
Tie it into the current crisis for us.
Well, and viewers may be interested to know that many of his previous books attracted just as much a controversy as the clash of civilizations.
So how does it relate to the crisis we're in now, Robert?
All right. Parker? What it relates to is that, you know, Huntington's book is much more subtle than it is usually given credit for. What he's saying is that Asia, though it's had its up and downs, is kind of like expanding militarily and economically, getting stronger. The Islamic world is expanding demographically, meaning there are more and more Muslims and bigger Muslim cities, so that the West, despite this high opinion we all have of ourselves, may actually be declining in relative influence, and that the future will be driven by Muslim assertiveness and Western arrogance and the clash of the two. And he talks about how no one will admit that, in fact, that, you know, there are cultural clashes. In fact, behind the lines, behind the scenes of many ongoing political crises, there is like a difference in cultures. And here is, I think, would be the most important thing to take away from his view. It's that the very fact that modern communications, email, jet travel, brings everyone more in touch with each other does not necessarily mean we will all like each other. It doesn't mean that because Chinese and Americans can communicate by email that that American-Sino relationships are going to get better. It doesn't mean that because Muslims can travel and live in the United States that some of them, at least, will automatically love the United States.
Robert Kaplan, let me turn to Jack Beatty right there. Jack, isn't any suggestion of a clash of civilizations in the war on terrorism exactly what the White House is taking great pains to avoid?
Yes, they want to have no part of any idea that we're in some sort of ineluctable conflict with the Muslim world. They want to sell this as a discrete war on terrorism within, perhaps harbored by states, but in the end, the terrorists are the focus, and their evil deeds are the focus, not their Islamhood. And I think that they want no part of any idea. It's almost as if, in fact, this has surfaced a little. The Prime Minister of Italy said something like this recently, and was immediately widely denounced. And I think
Berlusconi.
People are I think people are rightly nervous about this because this is exactly the way Bin Laden sees the world.
Robert Kaplan, you're saying get over it. There is a clash here.
I think you're missing the point.
Okay.
The purpose of a political scientist is not necessarily to help the world, but to describe what he thinks is actually going on in it, even if polite punditry and political leaders do not admit it. It's the responsibility of political leaders to deny this, but it's the responsibility of a social scientist, if he sees something, however unpleasant, behind the scenes, to write about it.
Robert Kaplan, we're very attuned to that tonight, and we see the difference.
science. But tonight is the night when we're looking at the social scientist's view of what's going on in the world. I take your point, Jack, and we can all see that the politicians don't want to fall into that. But yet, it's Robert Kaplan's view. Let's hear what our listeners have to say.
Well, you know, it's not only my view. Even Professor Huntington and others say it would be that the president is, in fact, doing the right thing.
Sure.
But the very fact that he's doing the right thing and not painting it as such does not mean that a social scientist cannot paint it as such, if that's what he sees is going on.
We take that point. Let's hear from our listeners. There, a lot of them are calling in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Inman is on the line. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I wanted to say I'm a Pakistani American.
Great to have you.
And thanks. I was born in this country. And before I go to the main point, I just wanted to say something about Samuel Huntington. This thing, idea of the clash of civilizations, I don't buy it. I find that, you know, if you want to look at where the world's hotspots are, you only need to look at where Britain, France, and Belgium had been during the colonial era, and that's where the world's hotspots are. It has really nothing to do with civilizational fault lines.
You're saying the bad legacy of colonialism.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, Kashmir, Israel, Palestine, West Africa, Central Africa. I mean, these are all, you know, Algeria. These are all places where colonialism has been, and these are the current hotspots.
And your thought on the current crisis, Inman?
Yeah, my main point that I called was that, you know, so I go back to Pakistan every couple of years and I see relatives who live there. And, you know, I would like to say that, you know, despite what the newspapers show, I mean, a lot of Pakistanis, they don't hate America. I mean, they actually have a sense of pride about America in the sense that, you know, they pride themselves that for 50 years mm-hmm. they have been an ally mm-hmm. with Pakistan. They feel, though, that they have been slapped in the face repeatedly by America, and this is the last, and this latest instance is after being slapped that they're asking for help. And I'll show you, I'll illustrate the point. And notwithstanding the whole Soviet era issue, you know, Pakistan was responsible for bringing or was instrumental in bringing China and America together.
Right, but Inman, let Robert Kaplan respond exactly to that point.
I have four quick responses.
Yes, please.
To that. First of all, you're actually right. When President Clinton went to Pakistan, he refused to shake hands with President Musharraf because he had not been democratically elected. Yet 24 hours later, Pakistanis were horrified to see Clinton embracing Hafez al-Assad, whose regime was far more repressive than that of any Pakistani ruler since 1947.
So you're pointing at American inconsistency?
There is a double standard mm-hmm. there, I admit. However, one has to admit that Pakistan and India combined could have 45% of the world's illiterate people, yet have the most skyrocketing defense budgets in the world.
Okay.
So there is a genuine concern there that cannot be denied. Regarding the whole colonialist legacy, about 80% of all sub-Saharan Africans and a similar percentage of Pakistanis and Indians were born after the last colonialist had left those territories.
So at some point we let go of that.
Tiresome,
okay, point three.
To blame colonialists.
Point three?
Yes. The next one is that the colonial era, which in fact had provided a stable gridwork of states for about two-thirds of the dry land surface of the earth, that it only in the 1990s started to fray in marginal places like Sierra Leone, Somalia, etc. In the next decade, the real challenge is that this colonial map is going to start fraying in much bigger, more complex societies like Nigeria, like Pakistan.
Does that mean, Robert Kaplan, that we are inevitably going to see more of the kind of attacks we saw in September? You talk about the West, the United States, being in the world's stretched limo, and outside there's a rundown, crowded planet with skinhead Cossacks, to use your words, and juju warriors. Is Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden part of that scene?
Nothing is inevitable. There's a lot we could do. But there's one thing you have to understand about terrorism. It's that the world is a world of increasing inequalities, and that is one of the motivators of terrorism. And as inequalities grow, the technological resources of terrorists grow too. It's not an accident that terrorism is the scourge of this age. It has to do with the very fact that modern war, which we can trace back to the Civil War when Lincoln and Grant and Sherman targeted the farms and factories and homes of Southern civilians. Mm-hmm. that modern war is increasingly targeted civilians for many reasons that we can go into. And precisely because the United States has the most sophisticated military in the world, any adversary is not going to come at us at our strongest point, but at our weakest point. They're going to make strategic use of the very freedoms that define what we are in the first place.
So, Jack Beatty, we are vulnerable by this definition.
Yeah, we are. But you know, to get back to a point Bob made earlier about democracy, you know, we don't just export Baywatch and military arms to the world. We export the democratic idea. And we have heard, we've had a kind of running seminar on this program for the past couple of weeks. We have heard again and again from journalists, from Americans of Muslim, who are of Muslim descent, again and again, that we support repressive regimes in that part of the world, that these regimes suppress democracy there, and that the reform impulse in the Muslim world, which presumably isn't all radical Islamicist, or there may be a vein that we could work on, that we're ignoring that. And then, in effect, we're breeding future Irans. Remember the Iran model. We thought that an authoritarian regime could last. We'd blink at its excesses, and we'd be able to deal with it as a Cold War chess piece. And, of course, in the end, it didn't work, and it produced 20 years of hatred from Iran, a radical Islamic regime there that has threatened our interests.
Yes, it has. Jack, we've got a caller speaking exactly to that point, and let's bring him into the conversation. Ian, you're on the line. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I actually want to disagree specifically with that point and say that I don't think that we export democracy at all. What I think we are exporting is actually stability. And I think the example that someone brought up about Hafez al-Assad and the president of Pakistan is a great one. Where I think that Hafez al-Assad represented a very stable government, whereas Pakistan maybe the president wasn't in a position of stability. And this goes to actually what Mr. Kaplan writes about a lot, is chaos. I think America really turns its back to chaos and embraces stability in whatever form it comes in, whether that
But the question is whether that serves our long-term interest to embrace stability above all. I mean, if there are splits here between regimes and peoples, oughtn't we? I don't say that we do export democracy. I'm saying that we should, that in a strange way, human rights is practical foreign policy for the United States, because it would give regimes who have stability. In the end, it's democracy that provides stability.
Ian, thanks.
Can I disagree with that?
Please, Robert Kaplan.
I not so much disagree with you, but just to explain something, is that exporting universalist principles of human rights can in many countries mean supporting elections, et cetera, like democracy, like Jack says, but in certain places it may not. And let me give you an example. Tunisia is probably one of the most enlightened, sophisticated countries in the Arab world. The freedoms there are incredible, yet it is not a democracy by any means. Algeria experimented with democracy, yet there is very little practical freedom. In many cases, the cruel irony of democracy is that it tends to work best when it emerges last. If you don't have a middle class, if you don't have institutions that work, if you have the kind of inflation and unemployment rates that Germany had in the 1930s and Italy in the 1920s, you're just as likely to get Hitlers and Mussolinis with democracies that are not undergirded by institutions than you are to get enlightened leaders. In fact, I'll tell you this right now. When democracy emerges in China, I will predict that the first decade or so, you're just going to get a bunch of nasty nationalist politicians who will compete with each other about how anti-American they can be.
Listeners, Robert Kaplan describes a tough world out there. Are you ready for this? Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Nigel is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, Nigel. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on the fact that much of this was a horrendous act that has happened, has taken some very many lives. The part that's very good, I think, is people are starting to ask questions now, because they're really starting to go, why do people hate us so much? And the fact of the matter is that the American government, in our name, the CIA and stuff, over the past 50 years has probably been responsible directly or indirectly for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people around this world in various countries, East Timor, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Angola, and other things. And it goes to prop up our lifestyle, which, I mean, America consumes about, what, 35% of the world's resources for 5% of the people?
That's a point we've all heard, but how does it play out? Thank you for your call, Nigel. Robert Kaplan, what about the inequities of consumption? Are they coming back to bite us here?
As countries economically develop, they consume more. If you look at China's economy, it's consuming in very much like the rates that the U.S. economy did after the Industrial Revolution. This cannot be stopped. You know, these are not things that governments regulate so much. If you look at Indonesia, if you look at Brazil, if you look at India, it's kind of like looking at the United States in the 1880s and 1890s. Corruption is always highest during ages of transition. This is commenting on the world, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with the kind of choices that governments face.
But you write a lot about the effects of resource starvation,
yes,
if you will.
Yes, and as countries get out of the Industrial Revolution into the post-industrial revolution, they tend to use their resources better. In a nutshell, over the next 10 or 20 years, in the Arab world, the amount of potable water per capita is going to go down by half, even as population rises continually by about 2% per year.
What on earth can we do about that?
We are going to see more stress, more instability in many of these countries.
President Bush speaks frequently these days to the fact that it is our way that will triumph. But Robert Kaplan, you've written that we should not assume. You've quoted Michael Vlahos saying, "Do not assume that the democratic capitalism is the last word in human evolution." Do you share that view?
Yes, I do, and I'll tell you why. That's why I think, for instance, Isaiah Berlin's anti-totalitarian philosophy of the Cold War will long outlast any of us, because there will always be totalitarian ideologies that we have to fight against. Just because communism has been vanquished doesn't mean that there won't be others. And if you look at history, the most stable and most enduring regime is not a democratic regime, and it's not an autocratic Latin American style military dictatorship either. It's a mixed regime that combines elements of democracy and those of dictatorship, some very subtle and humane, some not subtle at all and not humane at all. But it is a mixed regime that tends to survive. And I can provide many, many, many examples throughout the world of mixed regimes emerging.
Jack Beatty, any comfort in this for the American ear?
Well, I suppose there's if it's the nature of reality, we have to adapt ourselves to it. But I still have to go back to. I mean, I wonder, Bob, if you could devise a foreign aid budget, say aid to Egypt. Now, I don't know. We give them a couple of billion dollars a year. I don't know how much of that is military aid to strengthen these weak institutions, the law, the bureaucracy, and so on. How would you design an aid package that would deal with this problem of endemic anarchy that you see in the world? I mean, is there a role there for the West, not just to give arms, but to actually help reshape society?
Hold that thought. We're taking a break.
Yeah,
we'll come right back to that and solutions after a break. Listeners, join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the coming anarchy or maybe something better. You can also join the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. You can read an excerpt from our guest Robert Kaplan's book, The Coming Anarchy, on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror from WBUR in Boston.
From Boston University,
From WBUR Boston, this is Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a tough world out there, a lot of chaos, with journalist Robert Kaplan, author of The Coming Anarchy. Also with us is our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Callers, are we guilty of narcissistic isolationism? Is America ready to support a realistic and effective foreign policy? Is peace itself a problem? Has it made us soft and blind? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Robert Kaplan and Jack Beatty, just before the break, Jack was raising this issue. Robert Kaplan, if you could reshape U.S. foreign aid, what would it look like? What ills would it address, and how would it differ from today's foreign aid budget and focus?
Well, here are some principles. Politics are the sum total of human relations in any society. So the healthier the society is at the bottom, the healthier the politics tend to get on top, at the top. So, for instance, the most important thing of any foreign aid program would be teaching rural women how to read. When money is directed to women, it tends to fast forward cultural improvement at a much quicker rate than when it's directed to men, because women bring up the children. They tend to affect the culture much more. So things like family planning, women's literacy, digging water wells, in other words, the non-romantic, you know, bread and butter basics are the kinds of things that over time tend to improve a society at the bottom, and ultimately the politics at the top may get more restrained, more moderate. The problem is, I think Americans almost demand too much of foreign aid. These things take decades and decades. We can't expect, even in the best foreign aid program, that suddenly Egyptian politics and the media is going to suddenly get more restrained in 10 years. And in fact, foreign aid gets a bad rap. The way we spend foreign aid has improved dramatically in quality over the last 20 or 30 years.
But Robert Kaplan,
program in Egypt has been pretty good, actually, but these things just take decades.
Robert Kaplan, we were giving $40 million in aid to the Taliban to stop growing poppies. That didn't seem to buy us much.
Well, I'm not sure that it did. I mean, over the last, you know, from what I've read, actually, you know, opium production was reduced. But you can reduce, for instance, opium production dramatically in Nangarhar and Paktia province in eastern Afghanistan, and yet at the same time you can get a terrorist atrocity. There's no contradiction in that.
Let's bring our callers into the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255, looking at a tough world and the anarchy that may lie ahead. Andrew is on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Hi, John. Thanks for having me on the air.
Good to have you.
This is the first time I've been ever calling, so please bear with me if I'm
Go for it, man.
Jabbering you. I'm an American citizen. I was born here. My parents are from India. I think this is the best country in the world. One of the things that I've been wondering about, though, is I've been watching this media blackout between the issues involving Palestine and Israel. And I sort of think that has a huge impact of what's going on between the Arab nations and the American nations.
It's a good point, Andrew. Let us put it to Robert Kaplan. Robert Kaplan, that issue has been somehow on the sidelines since the September 11th attack.
Well, that's only because the terrorist thing has just obscured so much news, including that, but also other news. Here's how I would put it. None of our actions, or nothing Israel or any country has ever done, could ever justify what happened on September 11th. Nevertheless, there are political realities here. The United States cannot take on the whole Muslim world. It is going to play one part off against the other. It is going to make alliances with Arab leaders in many countries, because whether they're dictators or not, they are the only people to work with. But in making alliances with them, they are going to put themselves out on the line, and they are going to demand a political payoff in return. And ultimately, what that will result in is more American pressure on Israel to be more amenable in terms of compromising on the West Bank. That's a political reality, not a value judgment, and I expect that will play itself out in the coming months and years.
Let's keep the calls coming in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jeff is on the line. Jeff, welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks. I am really impressed by this conversation. I think that Mr. Kaplan is talking about things that people don't want to talk about, and specifically what he mentioned for suggestions for foreign policy, that type of stuff isn't going to fly. What we like to do in the U.S. is export products, you know, and we depend on energy to raise productivity. We want everyone else to get on that boat and start.
So what's the problem, Jeff? What's the problem with that? That's the American way, isn't it?
It's the American way, but it ends up the people that really want to do that in the other countries are elites, and the elites of the other countries don't mind putting the regular people down.
We've got your point.
So we support those. We don't mind that. We don't care what kind of government they have, as long as they get in line with us and get on the marketing and consumerist
trip.
Yep, let's put it to Robert Kaplan. Can our economic approach to the world, and that's what we've met by globalization for the last 10 years, is that sufficient? We've heard now for years that that is going to pull everything along in train behind and take us all to glory land. Do you buy it?
No, it won't, because economic growth by the nature, I mean, capitalism is like the bull in the china shop in history. Precisely because it's capitalism, it can't be controlled. So that the more dynamic the capitalist development, the more inequalities build up over the short term, and therefore the more incentives there are for populist outrage. We cannot help being what we are. We're expanding economically throughout the world because we are a dynamic people, and the Chinese are expanding because they are, and that gets back to that whole issue at the beginning of our conversation, Tom, with civilization clash. It's because each culture or region cannot ultimately help being what they are. In a world of mass communications, they will come into a certain degree of conflict, which we have to try to assuage and to deal with.
But what about peace?
Peace, you know, peace treaties are not made by altruistic people. They start as backroom deals by self-interested politicians. And if they're really cleverly arranged, they may eventually emerge into peace between peoples. Without the tools of dictatorship, Anwar Sadat in Egypt and King Hussein in Jordan never could have made peace with Israel. This is a very difficult, troublesome reality, but it's one that has to be faced. In a world of increasingly weak, transitioning democratic regimes, making peace treaties is going to be increasingly challenging for diplomats.
And yet, Jack Beatty, right now, peace is on everyone's lips. It's what everyone wants to regain after these terrible attacks.
Peace of mind, yeah. You know, it's unfortunate. The West is the carrier of modernization, and we've heard again and again from people how that, along with the Israel conflict, is one of the irritants, not justifications, one of the irritants to Islamic culture of the West today. That you know, our television, our values, and so on. It's just a shame, to go back to what I said originally, that our emphasis is on these things and not on what we see in this country, which of course is that people of different cultures get along, that we have a polycentric and in a multiracial society, that this is a kind of model for the world, not clash, but coexistence.
Robert Kaplan, we've just got about a minute and a half left. Is there room for the American ideal of diversity and harmony in diversity out there in the big, tough world we live in?
Yes, and I think one of the things that President Bush can say is when he's talking to the Muslim world, going to mosques, you know, wherever I've been in the Muslim world, I've met people in the smallest villages who have relatives in places like New Jersey. And President Bush can say, in America, it's you, the individual, what's happening. It's not the group that's happening. That's what's so incredible about America. And that's what we want. The people we are fighting against don't want you. They want the group that is happening.
Robert Kaplan, just 30 seconds left, but you've written before the September attacks that Americans lack the stomach to contemplate the world as it is. Do you think that's changing in the aftermath of those attacks?
Yes, I think it is, frankly. I mean, you know, America is a very lucky country. I mean, in the 1930s, we were riven by discord with horrible figures like Huey Long and Father Coughlin, and then Hitler and Tojo came around to save us and give us another 40 or 50 years of dynamism. You know, whenever we're really challenged by something that all of us can agree is really a bad force, I've been really impressed in recent weeks how this country has come together. It may be superficial, but who knows?
There you have it, listeners. Robert Kaplan reminding us that even Hitler and Stalin got us in gear and got us together. There may be some good that comes out of it. Robert Kaplan, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
It's my pleasure.
And Jack Beatty up there in Vermont Public Radio Land, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Click on WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people around the country in a segment we call Audio Diaries. John Curran is a sophomore at Wellesley High School in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Adolescence is, even in its best moments, a confusing time of life. For Curran and his friends, the September 11 attacks have replaced the Dawson's Creek variety of teenage agony with some very adult questions.
On the morning of September 11th, I was in the library reading the Drudge Report. On reading the news, I felt the same sinking feeling of dread that everyone had after learning of the attacks. For the rest of the day, classes congregated around televisions and radios, not chalkboards. There was an eerie calm throughout the hallways. Some students cried, while most watched TV, ashen-faced.
Someone came into the class and said that there had been a plane crash into the World Trade Center. I guess a first crash, it could have been an accident, but a second crash, you'd know. I was horrified. I knew that it could mean thousands of people killed. That's not a nice thought. Seeing the pictures just made it worse.
My first reaction was that it was probably a prank because about 3 weeks earlier I had been in New York and seen the towers, and it just didn't set in that they could be gone.
I was kind of just shocked because I really didn't get what these people thought this would accomplish.
Like the rest of the nation, my friends Thomas, Ben, and Steve were shocked upon hearing the news of the attacks. They struck so close. Several of my classmates lost loved ones. My friend Hassan thought this could never happen.
My mom was flying out of Logan Airport that morning, and, you know, I didn't know what flights had crashed into the World Trade Centers. Of course, assuming the worst, I thought it might have been her plane, and I almost had a nervous breakdown. I mean, losing the one person that ever really cared about me is... that tore me down to tears.
America's leaders tell us that our world has forever changed. But what does that mean? Will we ever get back our sense of security? Some of my friends are now talking about a war-torn, Orwellian future, complete with victory gardens and secret police. I don't want to believe them. But yet I read a poll that says over a third of New Yorkers support internment camps. This shocked me, so I did my own poll.
It's ridiculous to do something like that. You can't judge a whole race of people on the actions of an extremist view. It's inhumane, just as inhumane as crashing into the World Trade Center.
I don't think that internment camps are necessarily right because, I mean, look at the Holocaust. Look at World War II with the Japanese people living in California in the internment camps. I don't think that's right.
That's too extreme, and that's not right. It's not the American way. And we're all Americans, aren't we?
That's Hassan and Bonnie. Everyone I spoke with has questions about what will happen and how our lives will be different in the future. But we all hope that internment camps remain a thing of the past.
What do you think the United States or President Bush should do about this?
Bush has said many times that this is war, so I guess civilians will always die in a war, innocent civilians. And I'm assuming that Afghanistan's going to get the crap bombed out of them, but I guess there isn't any other actions to be taken against a fight against terrorism. I mean, the only action to take is to bomb the hell out of them.
Well, I think Bush is being an idiot. First of all, he said that they were going to close down the harbors of the terrorist country. Afghanistan is landlocked. I don't think he's necessarily the brightest bulb in the light switch. I don't know.
There's a lot of confusion at my high school, but everyone understands that our childhood of peace and prosperity has come to an end. Jeannie is a senior at Wellesley.
I see it as more than just the destruction of Twin Towers, but metaphorically the destruction of our sense of security, our peace, our perhaps even our arrogance.
However, for me, the events of September 11th mark the beginning of the world I will grow up in. A world with both ugliness and heroism. A world that might even experience war. An uncertain world fraught with danger, sacrifice, and fear.
John Curran is a student at Wellesley High School in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Over the next weeks, you'll be hearing more audio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for next week's audio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. Transcripts of the audio diaries featured on our special coverage are now available on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage of the aftermath of terror from WBUR in Boston.